Tape. We're still at Andy Weil's house. This is still the April 24th. This is tape three, side one. Oh no, we make it different sides, don't we? Side five. This is side five. Sorry. I was asking Mr. Weil before he goes back to his Second World War experiences, whether his grandfather ever related any stories about his meeting with Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, my grandfather mentioned, told in general terms about it, but I learned more about the details of his meeting with Teddy Roosevelt from two different sources. One, I think in 1911 or at the time this came out, I believe it was Collier's magazine, one of the magazines that was in circulation nationally at that time, had an article about the whole thing, told about it in detail, with pictures. They even had pictures of the holes in the door of the William Penn Hotel, and told about the sting operation, and had pictures of all the people involved, including the detective from Scranton, and told the whole story, and also told the story of my grandfather's meeting with Teddy Roosevelt, and described the meeting in quite a bit of detail, and told who was present and so forth at the meeting. And then later on my grandfather's 70th birthday, there was a party at Westmoreland Country Club, and they had speakers and people. And one of the members of the Voters League, who was still alive, as well as my grandfather, was present. I think it was George Wallace, who was one of the originators of the Voters League. He was still living, and he told everybody there about my grandfather's meeting with Teddy Roosevelt. Most of them had never heard the story before. Someone did,
yeah.
Some had. So.
And did he mention anything about Edgar Hoover?
My grandfather?
Yeah.
No, he didn't talk much. I came across the invitation. I have it here.
To the club?
To the club. That's how I knew about it.
And do you remember the name of the newspaper that you mentioned around 1909, 1911? You mentioned
which
the expose. Well, there was the newspaper that reported all the...
Oh, there were four or five papers in Pittsburgh.
And do you remember the names?
Let me get that for you.
Okay.
The names, because
all right.
They were...
The Sun Telegraph?
There was the Pittsburgh Sun, there was a Press, there was a Pittsburgh Leader.
Okay.
All of them.
All right.
But there were, I think, five different newspapers.
All right, we'll get this. Will you make a note? All right, now would you, I interrupted you from the last tape, the end of the last tape, about your liberating the concentration camp and the townspeople having to dig a grave at the, in front of this castle. Is there any more that you wanted to discuss?
Well, not really. I was going to show you in that book an address by our division chaplain, George Woods, who is an Episcopal minister. And following the war, we continued our friendship over many, many years. I was active in the 82nd Airborne Division Association. I was an officer, as was he, for a number of years. And for 3 or 4 years after the war, we had conventions in different cities, and Peggy and I would attend, and he and his wife would attend, and we saw each other at least once a year. And he made a very stirring speech at that service that was given, funeral service for all the people that were buried there. I'll show it to you afterwards.
Okay, I'd like to see it. Since you were in Europe, mm-hmm. from 1942 to the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I
wasn't in from 42 to the end of the war.
I have to ask you this as a mother. How did your parents feel when you told them that you would join the paratroops?
They were horrified.
I have to ask that.
Yeah, oh, yes. With one in the paratroops and the other in the Marines, they were probably scared out of their wits. Worried. They were concerned parents. But we... I wrote home a lot. I don't know whether my brother did or not, but I remember writing home at least once a week. So my parents got a lot of letters.
And will you tell us more about your years in the war?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
It's not much different than almost everybody else that served in the military during the war. Fortunately, I came back.
Can you describe the end when you found out that the war was over? Where were you?
Well, I was present when the war was ended because we met our division when we crossed the Elbe River. We were 100 miles or so from, maybe from Berlin. The Russians taken Berlin, and trapped between the Russians and us was a pocket of maybe 175,000, 200,000 Germans. This General von Tippelskirch that I showed you in the picture there was surrendering to the United States. He wanted to surrender to the Americans, not the Russians. So he asked to meet the American commander, and General Gavin, who was a major general, in a paratrooper uniform and a steel helmet, the general was introduced, and he said, "I know, I mean the commander." And the German general was a four-star general in charge of a whole army group, in a German great coat and a peak cap, and
He didn't consider Gavin his peer.
He couldn't believe that was the top officer. But anyway, he surrendered. He asked what the terms were, and General Gavin said, "Unconditional surrender. You lay down your arms and surrender." And
you were there. Was there some protocol of who would march into Berlin first? Weren't there
Berlin had been taken by the Russians as a result of the Tehran conference. It was agreed that Berlin would be divided into sectors.
In
the four sectors, yes. So that sometime after Berlin had been occupied by the Russians, they set up these sectors which had been agreed upon, and then the 82nd Airborne had been asked to occupy the American sector of Berlin,
So you were
the occupation of Berlin as part of the occupation force.
So we had the United States, we had France,
and Britain, and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians pulled. They had all of Berlin, so they pulled into the Russian sector, and we took over the sector that was for the Americans.
And can you tell me what the mood was? Some of the Germans that you saw, the citizens of Berlin, would you have any recollections of?
Well, Berlin.
What your feelings were because you had been to the concentration camp. I'd love to just get an idea of what your mindset was.
I'm sure you've heard before, but among the American troops, generally, the German people weren't really hated. The German army was an enemy, so of course you hate your enemy, but not the way we hated the Japanese. I don't think, by and large, the soldiers. They respected the Germans as good soldiers, and except where occasionally where atrocities were committed by an individual German commander, such as during the Battle of the Bulge, where there was a massacre of some Americans at Malmedy, and some of our parachutists in France were shot hanging, you know, from, they were in their harness hanging there from trees, and, disarmed and trying to surrender, they were shot. Except for instances such as that, the Germans treated our soldiers as we treated them. And in the prisoner of war camps, the Americans weren't mistreated as the Japanese mistreated our prisoners. We didn't have things like death marches and things like that. Generally, the Germans respected the Geneva Convention. And the German civilian population, as we went through Germany, were cooperative. There wasn't any resistance at all to the to our occupation of, you know, what, whatever. They were very fearful, of course, but they weren't people weren't mistreated by the American troops either. So,
so what do you have any opinions on? What happened with the concentration camps and in the Holocaust? I mean, do you have any? Do you feel that there's what happened there? We know what happened, but you as a soldier, going into Germany and respecting the military, and
mm-hmm.
and you saying that they respected the Geneva.
Well, this happened at the very end of the war. The war
okay.
was really over when we came into these concentration
right.
camps.
So what was your...
It was a small part. I mean, the townspeople, not that we believed them, but they claimed they did not know what was really going on in the camps. I don't think any sensible person really believed that the Germans didn't know. If they really didn't know the details, they sure as heck suspected what was going on. I'm sure they knew, and most of us felt they knew. But our feeling was, you know, what could they really do about it? Germany was a totalitarian country completely under the domination of a small group of fanatics, and the people pretty much couldn't do much about it, even if they tried. Some did try. Some in the military tried and were executed. They were hung on meat hooks.
Yeah.
By Hitler. Even those just knew about the plot were killed by Hitler. I mean, he was ruthless, and the SS people that ran these camps were deranged. A lot of them were deranged. They were, I understand, a lot of the prison guards and things were back from the Ukraine. They weren't even really Germans. They were conscripts. So they were brutal. I mean, as a soldier, we felt it was a horrible thing for humanity. Take place, but it was wasn't forgotten, but it was soon put away.
Yeah.
When we were in Berlin, we ran a concentration camp. We rounded up suspects of everybody that we could find or were pointed out to us who were in some way involved with the war crimes. We rounded up and put in a camp and guarded, and it was one of our jobs as occupation force in Berlin. We did not mistreat them. They were adequately fed and weren't mistreated.
Had the Nuremberg Tribunal was what, 47?
Hadn't started yet.
Yeah, but hadn't started. Was the beginning.
This was the beginning. They were incarcerated and being questioned.
Okay, now you're home. You came. When did you leave Europe to come home?
In 1940, we arrived home in January of 46.
And did you immediately go back to graduate school, or you mentioned that you had graduated at already?
I went to law school with them.
Okay, and where did you go?
Pitt Law. I went to Pitt Law School, and was there, 46, 7, and 8.
And you're now practicing?
And I'm now practicing. Well, I'm now semi-retired.
Okay. Andy, is there any unfinished business that you have? Is there anything that you haven't done that you would still like to do, or talk about your hobbies, or?
No. My grandfather, at that anniversary dinner celebrating his full life, said there wasn't one chain in his link that he would want changed in any way. I pretty much feel the same way. You know, I've had a very full, happy, rewarding life. Mine isn't over, I hope, by a long way. And I can't think of anything I'd want to change at all. I was about to say, we have a very close family. Our children were brought up to do things together as a family. We've always done things together. And we took Peggy and I didn't run off on a vacation and leave the children, except when they were very, very little, when we took a couple of ski trips before they were old enough to go along with us. As soon as they were on skis and we took a ski trip, they went along. And from that time on, we just took vacations as a family. We raised them here in this home. I think I told you that our house this year will be 200 years old.
I'd like you to tell us about your house and the Powers.
Yeah, well, this back in 1795, James and John Powers, who were early residents in Pittsburgh, bought property here in O'Hara Township. They bought a tract of ground that was had been given to Joseph Mercier as part of payment for Revolutionary War services. Apparently, Mercier was from Philadelphia and died, and the tract of ground that was given to him to pay him for serving as a soldier in the Revolutionary War ran from the Allegheny River out what is now Powers Run Road to where it meets Fox Chapel Road, out near where what we used to call the Bending Oak, which is no longer there. It's just past Fox Chapel Golf Club. And on ground where we now sit, one of the Powers built, James Powers built a log cabin.
And we're sitting in it.
Where we're now sitting, which is now our living room. It's 25 by 25 feet, two stories high. And as you can see, it's all logs.
Could you describe it?
They're square-hewn logs. This is typical of the log cabins that were built at that time. They had sort of a general plan that would 25 feet square, and the inside and outside were squared. The logs were two sides were flattened, were made almost like square instead of just a round log, and they're hand hewn, and you can see the axe marks where they were cut along the logs. They have a gray color. These are unstained. The gray-white color is from plaster because sometime years ago in the 1800s, it was conceived, people that lived in log houses were considered like in Poverty Row, if they had a log house. It was considered being very lower class. So they lathed over and plastered the insides of the logs so that from the inside you couldn't tell it was plastered. I mean, couldn't tell it was a log house. And what had been the second story, they slept. In the old days, they slept up
in the log
and had a ladder that would go up. You can still see the notch there where the ladder had been notched in. And many years ago, of course, then they put a ceiling in. This would have been just a room. That would have been an attic up above the rafters.
Is it treated at all, Andy, for fire? Or
no.
So it's not a hazard, or I mean.
No, I suppose if you put a blowtorch, it would catch on fire. But it's hard to drive. That wood is so hard, you can almost not drive a nail into it.
So there's been no. You haven't done any restoration in this room at all.
We haven't. No, but sure, there's been some restoration done over the years.
The windows.
Nothing to the logs, really. The logs are all original. And the cement between the logs, of course, that replaced just mud platen. Originally, they put straw and mud between the logs to keep the winter out, cold.
Now, when you bought the house, you had this room. You've made some additions since you've bought the house, but what?
We added very little. We made did a lot of interior remodeling, but the only thing we added on was the porch and garage. Everything else was just the way it is today.
And how many acres are you sitting on?
Right, we bought 14 acres when we bought the property. And we sold off over the years, we sold off all but we kept 4 acres until just a few years ago when we donated some property to the O'Hara Township for a nature reserve. All of the property down to the stream, there's a pond and a stream in the back, and along the rear of the property was donated and is now a nature reserve.
And your wife is quite a gardener, isn't she?
Yeah, she's a very, very active gardener. She certainly is.
You have an exquisite garden, and you've helped with it?
Yes, I help. I help taking the garden. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think Gabby wants to ask some questions.
Yes,
Gabby.
Can we backtrack a little? I want to know about the towns that were devastated by them in Germany. The towns that you mentioned.
Okay.
About
15 miles south of Ulm, in which Jews were not permitted to live. Ulm was a Protestant. Actually, Ulm was a free city. I guess you might say it was the principal city of Wartenberg, one of them. And Jews were permitted to come there to trade, but they weren't allowed to live there at that time. So they formed settlements, little towns, close enough to Ulm so that they could come and trade. And most of the Jews were peddlers, itinerant peddlers, or traders. If they had had a trade or store or anything, they would trade mainly among their own people. Of course, if they lived in a town, they could have any kind of a business they want. But in a place like Ulm, they couldn't belong to a trade union and be a tinsmith or leather worker or any of those. The union, the craft unions, the crafts wouldn't allow Jews to become members. So jobs were very, very limited as to what Jews could do. And in many of the principalities and kingdoms which existed in Germany at that time, Germany was not in the 1830s and early 40s, was not united. There were probably forget, maybe 100 different free cities and principalities and kingdoms and everything else all over Germany. And each one was ruled and governed in accordance with the king or prince or duke or whoever was in charge. And some were benevolent, some weren't. In Bavaria, in some of the areas, for example, around Altenburg and Illyricum, as I said, where my Illyricum and Altenstadt were little villages right next to each other. It was like almost like Sharpsburg and Sharpsburg and where you, two, you can hardly tell where one begins and the other ends. There were only maybe 100 families in each of them, or less. But the people that lived there, their children weren't allowed to remarry unless somebody else died. You know, there were restrictions. There were maybe dozens of restrictions on what sort of livelihood they were permitted to have. They couldn't go in the military. They could be conscripted into the military, but they couldn't become an officer or anything. They could, in some of the places, they couldn't even go into the military. In others, they could, but they couldn't be an officer.
What these towns may have only
seen? Yeah, Altenstadt and Illyricum. And many others like it were the only ones that lived there were Jews.
Some of the towns have streets called Judenberg and Judenstrasse that we've run into it in Laupheim where they were.
Mm-hmm. And now the other town was where my great grandmother lived, and then. One of my great-grandfather's siblings lived in Ichenhausen, Ichenhausen. And I think that's where my great-grandmother died, in Ichenhausen, where one of her daughters, who didn't come over. Some of my great-grandmother's family came over to the United States. Some did not, because I found in a scrapbook kept by my uncle, Nathaniel, a little clipping that said my great-grandmother had gone back to Germany to visit her mother, who was apparently dying. Something like that.
Like your great-grandfather went back to
his father. Yes, and she had gone to Ichenhausen, where apparently one of her daughter lived, and my great-grandmother's mother had gone to live with.
Okay, so. Then you mentioned that these towns were literally flattened.
Yes, back in the late 1930s, Hitler I guess the people were sent to concentration camps, and the towns were flattened. The buildings and the synagogue and everything were just demolished. And today, as such, they do not exist unless, I'm sure there are towns there, but they aren't called those names. And those towns appear in that book that I mentioned to you.
The book Where We Stand.
Where Once We Stood. Let's see.
You know who wrote that?
You want to turn off the tape while I look for it?
Tape on? Okay. What was the name of the book, Andy?
I'm corrected. The name of the book is Where Once We Walked.
Okay.
Gary Mokotoff, M-O-K-O-T-O-F-F, is the author. It was published in Teaneck, New Jersey, by A-R-O-T-A-Y-N-U in 1991. And you can find it in the Carnegie Library, in the social... I saw it in the when I was in the Pennsylvania room working on research for my book. I came across it just there. It was brand new. I mean, it just been received. But it's a whole list of every town throughout the world where once there was a predominantly Jewish settlement that no longer exists.
One other question that I had, what was the lifelong, the date of the voters? It began in, when did it end?
When did what end?
The voters group as a viable organization.
The ROTC?
No, the voters group.
Oh, the voters
yes.
League. It ended in the early 1920s.